Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the acrimonious meltdown in Congress this last couple of days following a press conference by Representative John Murtha, who called for the United States to withdraw its troops from Iraq. There was a very, very contentious debate in the House on Friday that where the Republicans essentially hijacked Murtha's proposal and introduced their own counterfeit resolution. So we'll be talking to Robert Dreyfus, who is writes extensively on Iraq, the war on terrorism, and national security for The Nation, The American Prospect, and Rolling Stone. His new book is Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Islamic Fundamentalism. He has a piece in the forthcoming December issue of Rolling Stone entitled Getting Out of Iraq. And since that was the subject of Representative Murtha's speech, we'll be talking about whether or not we've reached a turning point in terms of the Iraq debate. Not that we had a debate before we went into that war, but now it appears a debate is underway about how to get out, if and when. And we'll also talk with Dean Lawrence Velville, who practiced law in the Department of Justice and in the private sector. He's written numerous briefs for the Supreme Court, and has been a law professor at the University of Kansas Law School, Catholic University, and he's one of the founders of the Massachusetts School of Law. We'll be talking to Dean Velville about the special prosecutor, how he has apparently impaneled a new grand jury and has continuing his investigation. We'll explore what that investigation might mean. And of course, this is in the context of Bob Woodward, the Washington Post reporter, who just revealed that he knew before anybody else about Valerie Wilson, the wife of the ambassador, who was outed by a column from Robert Novak that led to the special prosecutor and the indictment of Scooter Libby. So we'll be looking into what impact Woodward's revelations have on that. We'll explore that subject further with Lawrence Walsh, who served as the independent counsel for the Iran-Contra hearings, and we'll be talking to him about echoes of from back in those days to the current situation, given that what is commonly known today as the neocons first came to public attention in the Iran-Contra scandal, and they seem to have also had their fingerprints over the current scandal. Let's now go to the subject of the meltdown in the Congress in the last couple of days and the emergence of a debate now, thanks to Representative Murtha, about whether or not the United States should get out of Iraq, and soon. I'm speaking with Robert Dreyfus, who writes extensively on Iraq, the war on terrorism, and national security for The Nation, The American Prospect, and Rolling Stone. His new book is Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam, and he has an article in the forthcoming December issue of Rolling Stone entitled Getting Out of Iraq. And of course, this week has been a pretty tumultuous week in the Congress with Representative John Murtha's press conference and then the bill that was introduced in the House, essentially a poison pill bill that was hijacked by the Republicans. It led to this extremely acrimonious debate. What's your feeling, though, about the level of emotion? Is there something, is this some kind of have we reached a kind of boiling point or a tipping point here in the non-debate about Iraq?
Yeah, I think this week will go down in history as the week that the political establishment turned against the war in Iraq. Now, then the public, of course, has been, you know, gradually turning against the war for the past 18 months, I would say. And the succession of bad news out of Iraq has inflamed public opinion. But now what you're finding is Congress and other parts of the establishment finally catching up. It wasn't just the House debate. Earlier this week, the Senate voted basically to you know, slap President Bush over the war when first the Democrats and then the Republicans introduced successive bills, and of course the Senate passed one. Now you had the debate in the House where people were literally shouting at each other. It is a war. It does deserve, I think, a high level of emotion. But what you're having unfold now in Washington is, a true level of panic among the members of Congress, especially those who supported the war, as they look forward to 2006 and the fact that the public is so overwhelmingly in favor of getting out of Iraq.
And is there any awareness that this debate that we're having about Iraq is the very debate we should have had back before the war, particularly in October 2002 when the war resolution was passed? I think historians will judge that moment as a total failure of the American democratic system and, in particular, a failure of the opposition.
Well, you know, what's the difference between now and 3 years ago is that the trauma of 9/11 has faded. And President Bush and Vice President Cheney used that trauma to stampede the American people after 9/11 into an attack on Iraq. And he used that trauma to stampede Congress into authorizing his war. So the fact that the intelligence was, as I've written and many others, has been manipulated and fabricated over the period before the war is now contributing to, I think, an increasing level of public disgust as the fog clears and they realize that it wasn't Iraq that attacked us on 9/11, despite the president's assertions, and that, in fact, the war in Iraq is making the terrorism problem worse. So the public wants a way out, and everything that's happened from the Abu Ghraib scandal to the indictment of the vice president's chief of staff, Scooter Libby, is just adding to that sense of what I believe is disgust and dismay on the public's awareness about the situation over there.
Well, in your forthcoming article, Robert Dreyfus, in Rolling Stone, Getting Out of Iraq, the only remaining question is not how to win the war, but how to end it. You begin by saying President Bush is about the only person left in America who doesn't get it, that the war is lost. What would it take, do you think, for reality to intrude upon him?
Well, I address that in my article because I truly believe that if we get out of Iraq, we can't wait until 2009 when a new president takes over. So President Bush is going to be the one who signs the order to get out. So I laid out at the end of that piece three possible scenarios, and I'll run through them quickly. I think all three could happen at once, actually. First, the military, the generals, could go to Rumsfeld and say, "We can't win this. It's time to get the heck out of here," and tell Rumsfeld to go knock on the president's door and explain that to him patiently.
Well, I understand the military have already told Representative Murtha that, and that's why he went public.
I have no doubt that that's true. I mean, Murtha is a 30-year veteran of Congress and also a former Marine and has very close ties to the generals, and I'm sure that he's reflecting the message that he's getting from at least the people that he talks to. So the military is one force that I think will start to act on the White House, and already is, in fact. The second one, I think, is I believe that some wise men of the conservative and mainstream parts of the Republican Party, it could be anyone from James Baker and Brent Scowcroft to Newt Gingrich to Colin Powell to many others, could get together with the president, as happened with Lyndon Johnson after the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, when some people like Clark Clifford and Averell Harriman and other wise men sat down with Johnson and, of course, convinced him not to run for re-election and to start peace talks. The third possible thing that could happen is that the political honchos, people like Karl Rove and others, and whatever you think about Karl Rove, his only real allegiance is to President Bush and his political fortunes. He's not an ideologue. He's not a neoconservative. But he's a political extremist in the sense that he's extreme in his defense of Bush, that the political honchos in the White House could realize that the fortunes of the Republican Party are going down the toilet if they don't get out of Iraq in 2006 and then in 2008. So I think on the military level, on the establishment expertise level, and on the political electoral level, all three of these things could come together to persuade President Bush to, in fact, change the course. And I, by the way, will not begrudge him, although I will continue to write bad things about him, but I won't begrudge him if he pulls out of Iraq and claims victory. I don't care what he says. The important thing is that we declare victory and get out. And now the only debate, really, is how do we get out? In other words, can we get out, as John Murtha says, in 6 months? Can we get out in 12 months, as other people say? Will it take 2 years? Can we pull out tomorrow? I mean, there's going to be a debate about how to get out of this tar baby that we've stuck our hands in and feet into.
Well, it's worth noting, Robert Dreyfus, that George W. Bush has more time left in his second term as president than Jack Kennedy had in his 1,000 days. So we will have a lame duck. It's just a question of whether or not he faces reality. But I think in terms of what has set a cat amongst the pigeon this week and has become the catalyst for this debate, which, as I mentioned, we should have had before we went into this war, it's interesting to note that John Murtha has achieved in a few minutes what John Kerry and people like Bob Schrum and the Democratic establishment spent hundreds of millions of dollars in the last election cycle and failed to do. Let's run a clip of what John Murtha says, and then I'll have you comment on it, Robert.
The war in Iraq is not going as advertised. It's a flawed policy wrapped in illusion. The American public is way ahead of the members of Congress. The United States and coalition troops have done all they can in Iraq, but it's time for a change in direction. Our military is suffering. The future of our country is at risk. We cannot continue on the present course. It is evident that continued military action in Iraq is not in the best interest of the United States of America, the Iraqi people, or the Persian Gulf region. General Casey said in September 2005 hearing, the perception of occupation in Iraq is a major driving force behind the insurgency. General Abizay said on the same date, reducing the size and visibility of the coalition forces in Iraq is a part of our counterinsurgency strategy.
So, Robert, any comments there on this statement, which is only a piece of it? He went on to castigate Vice President Cheney, who had criticized Democrats for lacking in backbone by saying that he really, you know, it's pretty choice coming from guys who got five deferments who don't want to talk about a war that they have never experienced. Your comments?
Well, I think that what Congressman Murtha is saying publicly is what scores and scores of other people in Congress are saying privately. And that's the real issue here. If he were just one lone voice speaking out, they could dismiss him and ridicule him. But in fact, I think really he's expressing the majority opinion on probably both sides of the aisle. I've talked to Republicans. I just wrote a profile that's coming out in Mother Jones of Walter Jones, a congressman from very conservative district in East North Carolina.
Where Camp Lejeune is, right?
That's right, and he's introduced a resolution with some other Republicans and a bunch of Democrats to you know, basically start getting an exit strategy rolling. I mean, I think the tipping point has been reached in Congress, and this is a tragic war which is a blot on America's moral standing. And you know, Murtha is standing on the shoulders of Cindy Sheehan, who energized public opinion. She was standing on the shoulders of the people who leaked the Abu Ghraib scandal and the photographs to the press. I mean, there's a whole history of this. The people who've spoken out about the intelligence manipulation People like Colonel Wilkerson, you know, Colin Powell's chief of staff. And now you have the Senate Intelligence Committee investigating the intelligence manipulation in 2002, 2003. You have the Pentagon Inspector General, it was just announced 2 days ago, investigating Douglas Feith and his secret office in the Pentagon. You have a special prosecutor investigating efforts by the White House, having already indicted one top official who tried to suppress those like Joseph Wilson, who spoke out about the intelligence manipulation. So, I mean, all of this stuff, Inspector General, Senate investigations, special prosecutors, is coming to bear on the White House. This is intolerable pressure. No White House can survive an all-points attack like this. So, in my opinion, not only have they lost the war in Iraq, but they've lost the war at home. And now the question is, do we demand unconditional surrender by the White House, or do we negotiate terms?
Well, you could also argue, of course, that all this happened because of the insurgents, and not because of the democratic process or the lack thereof here in the United States.
I couldn't agree with you more about that. The fact that I call them the resistance in Iraq, and I do not include Zarqawi's crazies and so forth in that. But the nationalists and the military and the Ba'athists in Iraq did not go quietly into the night. And I should mention to your listeners, an extremely important event is unfolding in Cairo as we speak. The Arab League, along with several Arab leaders, President Mubarak of Egypt, President Bouteflika of Algeria, the Saudi foreign minister, and many others, including the Iranian foreign minister, are meeting in Cairo yesterday, today, with all of the leaders virtually of Iraq, with Ba'athists, with members of the resistance waiting in the wings, and they're discussing a conference that will unfold in January to negotiate an all-parties settlement. And the Kurdish president of Iraq, Jalal Talabani, has said that he is willing to talk to the Ba'athists and to the insurgency. So this is a stunning development that came about in the face of American counter-organizing. You'd think that the Bush administration would have organized this meeting itself and supported it. But in fact, Condoleezza Rice and the U.S. military and our ambassador in Iraq all threw cold water on this very, very important Arab League initiative, which has the potential to organize a ceasefire in the war in Iraq and bring the Sunni insurgency back into the mainstream political process in Baghdad. I can't emphasize enough how critically important this meeting is. It's still possible, of course, that the United States can wreck it by simply twisting the arms of these Shiite fanatics to oppose any opening to the resistance. But
well, they're the people we've handed the most valuable part of Iraq over to. I mean, I guess you, in your article in Rolling Stone, Robert Dreyfus, you mentioned Bill Odom, who I've talked to a couple of times about this, and he takes the position that we're totally screwed at any rate, so it doesn't matter whether, you know, the chips fall as they may. They've already falling in such a way that it's a complete catastrophe. I mean, it does seem that we've perhaps created a kind of surrogate war there by having rewarded the Iranians, whose surrogates, the Shiites, we support. We're actually the Iraqi army that we keep talking about. As they stand up, we'll stand down. Well, it's an entirely Shiite Kurd army. The Sunnis, the Sunni patrons, the Saudis, the Egyptians, the Jordanians, won't see them defeated. So they'll step in.
No, but you know something else? The Shiites and the Kurds don't like each other. And it's entirely possible that the Kurds will switch sides.
They keep switching sides. They have a history of...
Absolutely.
And they're basically run by two rival mafias, Talabani and Barzani.
Mm-hmm.
And then if the Kurds opt out, the Turkish army will probably invade or at the very least cut off their oil lifeline. So there aren't any particularly good scenarios. It really does echo what Colin Powell tried to warn the president in the first place before he went into this war, that once you break it, you own it. Well, it's certainly broken, and nobody wants to own it. So I guess my question is there any incentive on the part of the neighborhood to recognize the scope of the catastrophe, how much greater it could get, and are they willing to weigh in?
Oh, absolutely. I think that all of the surrounding countries, from Turkey and Iran to all of the Arab countries to the south and west, are petrified that if Iraq implodes, it will draw all of them in. I think they have every incentive in the world to try to prevent this from happening. On the other hand, if it does happen, they will be drawn in on opposing sides. So there is a huge incentive for Iraq's neighbors to help stabilize the situation.
But instead of us encouraging the Iranians, who admittedly are a disgraceful regime, and likewise the Syrians, rather than encouraging them to get real, we're actually threatening them.
Oh, I wrote that in my article that you mentioned, that instead of trying to get the help of Syria and Iran, we're threatening them with regime change. So this is utter stupidity on the part of the Bush administration. And now we find ourselves supporting an Islamic fundamentalist theocracy in run by these Shiites. I mean, it was just uncovered this week that the Shiite militias run secret torture prisons where hundreds of Sunnis are having the skin flayed off of them and electric drills penetrating their bones. I mean, this was a horrific example of Saddam Hussein levels of torture.
Well, there's, of course, the Barter Brigade are the people that ran the POW camps. They were the Iranian surrogates during the Iran-Iraq War. So the Sunni officer corps has deep and bitter memories of them. I mean, it's amazing. We don't have time to catalogue everything that went wrong, from the botched occupation through the way that the forces are now configured in what is an incipient civil war, and it's just a question of whether it blows up into the open or not. And
I will say this, though. The fact is that before the war, if you want to list the intelligence failures and manipulations, before the war, we knew that these Shiite fundamentalists were likely to take over and run Iraq. We knew who they were. We knew that they were supported by Iran. We knew that the Badr Brigade was created by Ayatollah Khomeini in 1982. We knew everything we needed to know, that we were creating a theocracy. And as I wrote in my book about how the United States helped to unleash Islamic fundamentalism, well, yes, that's exactly what we've done in Iraq. And we're now using our 150,000 troops there to keep in power a regime that would have no abilities to sustain itself were it not for the American presence. The Shiite government in Iraq, though it represents the majority in terms of its religious affiliation, doesn't even represent the majority of the Shiites, most of whom, especially in the cities, were far more liberal and secular-minded than these paramilitary groups like the Badr Brigade, which is enforcing this theocratic discipline in places like Basra and Najaf and Karbala. So we've created a monster in Iraq. And there's no question in my mind that were it not for the United States presence, this regime wouldn't survive more than a few weeks.
Well, I guess just in closing, Robert Dreyfus, I certainly would be sorry to see Chalabi go. It's not the only people who profited from this horrible situation so far have been the contractors, the Halliburtons, in this kind of frenzy of crony kleptocracy that Vice President Cheney seems to be running. Also, same thing's happening down in New Orleans, it turns out. But Chalabi is certainly an established kleptocrat. He's in charge of the oil. He's in charge of all contracts. You know, we I can't wait for the accounting to come in on how much money was stolen here. There's going to be a lot of retribution, and I guess if the Democrats take back the House or the Senate, then have subpoena power, they can look into this horrible raid on the Treasury.
Well, you're right about Ahmed Shalabi. I think one of the truly astonishing things that's happened in the past few weeks is his trip to Washington and the fact that he apparently has the support of major players in the Bush administration to become the next prime minister of Iraq. It's astonishing because he has zero support among the Iraqi people. He's one of the most hated people in Iraq. I think the latest poll that was released on individuals showed that Shalabi had the support of 2% of Iraq had a favorable opinion of him. So, and that's probably mostly his extended family. So he's as crooked as they come.
Right.
And yet he's one of the people that the neoconservatives in particular have latched onto because he dresses well, he speaks perfect English. He's one of them, you know. So you can't help if you're a neoconservative to like Shalabi because he's part of your team.
Well, I wish all the neoconservatives would go over to Iraq and preside over its future, in quotes, with great irony.
Well, maybe they could have their own jihad over there.
Right.
You know, that neoconservatives around the world could flock,
go there and rescue the place.
Into the neighboring countries and sneak across the border and fight a jihad. But I don't think that you're going to find people like the well-fed Richard Perle going to Iraq to fight a jihad anytime soon.
No, well, obviously, we're being facetious because it is a complete catastrophe. Bush should be pilloried, put in the stocks for what he's done, and the country will suffer incredibly for this. And the jihadis who already believe they drove the Soviets out of Afghanistan and brought down the Soviet Empire will now, as America is inevitably defeated in Iraq, will believe that they've humbled both superpowers and they'll be drunk with power. So there's no good outcome, but I guess just the bottom line is it's getting so much worse every day that with or without us, it's going to go to hell in a handbasket, and it might as well happen without us.
Well, it's important to understand, though. I saw Rumsfeld today on CNN, and he said, imagine if we left Iraq and the Zarqawis took over. Well, the fact is that the jihadists and al-Qaeda are only a very, very small part of the Iraqi resistance, and they are not going to take over if we left tomorrow.
No, I think the local people will round them up and kill them, probably. But
the Sunni resistance, and it's not even the Sunni because there are some Shiites and Kurds involved in it, but the opposition in Iraq is overwhelmingly, first of all, homegrown, not foreign infiltrators, and second of all, not religious fanatics. These are the people who, for better or worse, ran Iraq for the past 30 years, and you can certainly accuse them of much wrongdoing, but certainly not of being linked to al-Qaeda. That was President Bush's big lie in advance of the war,
which they extracted from al-Libi via torture.
Yes, I like to make the parallel between our lying Libi and theirs. I wonder if somehow they have family connections.
Right.
Louis Libi and Sheikh Libi, who both lied about the pre-war intelligence.
Well, at least Scooter Libby wasn't tortured, at least as far as we know.
Well, it's kind of a...
He should be tortured by history. Anyway, I'm afraid we've run out of time. I thank you so much. And the forthcoming issue of Rolling Stone, your article, is definitely worth a read. Getting out of Iraq, the only remaining question is not how to win the war, but how to end it. I thank you for joining us, Robert Dreyfus.
Thanks very much. I've enjoyed it a lot.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Robert Dreyfus, who writes extensively on Iraq, the war on terrorism and national security for the nation, the American prospect, and as you mentioned, the Rolling Stone article in the forthcoming edition. His new book is Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. I'm now speaking with Lawrence Velville, who is a graduate of the University of Michigan Law School and has practiced law in the Department of Justice in the private sector. He was a law professor at the University of Kansas Law School and Catholic University, and he is now one of the founders of the Massachusetts School of Law, where he currently serves as dean. And Dean Velvel, the special prosecutor has impaneled a new grand jury. Apparently, he has further investigation. After the indictment of Scooter Libby, he left hanging the possibility of others, including Karl Rove. But now that Bob Woodward has revealed that he was an earlier recipient of the leak about Valerie Wilson, there's an expectation, at least on the part of Libby's lawyers, they were overselling how it impacted on the five indictments. But what's your reading on whether the Woodward cat amongst the pigeons is going to have any impact?
Well, I think anything currently, Ian, is speculation. I can speculate. It's probably reasonably educated speculation. Of course, Libby's lawyers will use this to prove that, or to try to prove, that outing claim was no big deal, because, in fact, lots of people in Washington did know about it. They'll use it to try to prove that there was no animus behind this, no animus over the claims made by Joseph Wilson. Technically speaking, they will probably use it to try to prove, and this would be quite amazing, really, that Russert and Miller and Matthew Cooper were all either lying or mistaken in what they said they told Libby, and that only Libby is right in what he said. They will probably use it, although it's not technically a defense to the charge of perjury. They will probably use it to try to say that you see, the whole thing was no big deal. There's no national security crime here, and since the whole thing was really no big deal, you shouldn't prosecute Libby. The very same kind of defense, by the way, that we saw just a few years ago. If you want a little equal-handedness, we saw Bill Clinton and his people try and pull off, saying that it was all right to perjure himself in a deposition because of what he was talking about was no big deal.
That doesn't make perjury and obstruction of justice go away, though, does it?
Well, not legally speaking. And to those of us like myself who are old-fashioned and grew up and still believe in a lot of things that were current in the 1950s, I mean, it's just appalling. You just ought not to be lying, period, let alone to a grand jury or in a deposition.
Well, now, that Dean Velvel, that gets you to the real, I think, where the rubber meets the road in this issue, and that is, why would an experienced lawyer like Scooter Libby lie before a grand jury? It doesn't make sense. So, obviously, it was a calculated decision on his part, and perhaps on others, like Cheney, for him to lie, because, in effect, he was falling on his sword. By lying to the grand jury, he then obfuscated, as Fitzgerald said in his press conference, you know, they threw up the screen, this like the sand in the umpire's face, and they delayed and delayed and delayed and counted on the members of the press covering for them. And in delaying it, they delayed it past the 04 elections, where had Libby not perjured himself, Fitzgerald would have been able to find out pretty quickly what happened, and the findings and results would have been embarrassing for Bush prior to the election. So if you take that logic that Libby has already fallen on his sword, then the next step is, what kind of a deal is he going to try and get? And ultimately, will he be pardoned by President Bush?
Well, it sounds like you've read my blog.
well, I'm trying to summarize. I entirely agree with you, by the way. I mean, it seems to me the most logical explanation.
Yeah, well, what I said in the blog, as you have repeated, number one, I think that Libby felt he had to protect Cheney. I think it's a speculation, but that would be my speculation. I felt number two, that Libby thought the election could very well be at stake, and that too is a speculation. But again, it's my speculation. I thought that he felt he could get away with it because he probably banked on the fact that the reporters would defy the prosecutor and not testify, and that they would be backed by very wealthy organizations that could fight this forever all the way to the Supreme Court and delay it immensely, and that is exactly what happened. Libby was the lawyer for Mark Rich. He's well aware of the fact that pardons can be given to the most guilty by the president. And it has, and whether Libby is now going to seek a deal, as one would have thought, as I would have thought, I think has come into question because it has at least been announced that he is seeking a $5 million fund. A lot of the neocons are sponsors of the effort to raise this legal defense fund. And I think they're going, I mean, at least currently, it looks as if they're going to fight this to the bitter end and rely on the possibility of a pardon, just as I guess I said in the blog that that Ronald Reagan pardoned Caspar Weinberger. Somebody wrote to me and said that was mistaken. It was actually George Bush the first that pardoned Weinberger, who had protected George Bush the first by not turning over his notes, which mentioned that George Bush the first was at a meeting at Iraq-Contra. But whoever pardoned Weinberger, the fact is he was pardoned. So there is precedent for this, the Mark Rich case, and that whole congeries of, what, 100 pardons that Clinton issued in his last days. There are precedents for this, unfortunately.
Well, of course, Lawrence Vel, we'll be talking in a moment with Lawrence Walsh, the Iran-Contra special prosecutor, and I'll ask him about that. What you just brought up. But I think what you're saying here is that the strategy on the part of Scooter Libby and his legal team is to drag this thing out as long as possible, because it means he does less jail time before he's pardoned by Bush when Bush leaves office. I imagine it'll be too politically incendiary for Bush to pardon him before he leaves office.
Well, before he leaves office is the only time.
I mean, right away. In other words,
immediately
that he's sentenced, then the next day Bush could pardon him. But remember what happened with Gerald Ford. So he may want to sort of wait until he's out of office or on his way out of office. But what impact then will? I mean, I tell you what's so distressing about this is that it has turned Thomas Jefferson's First Amendment on its ear. Instead of the press being the advocates for the powerless, they have, in this case, become the protectors of the powerful. And Bob Woodward has now entered the fray, and he seems to be going the way of Judith Miller in the sense that he has traded access for influence and is in a position where he basically lied, as she did, to her own paper. And now, how do you think the chips are going to fall in this case?
Well, I can't say how the chips will fall with Woodward. I can say that, as you indicated, he has now been accused of access journalism and being a stenographer for the Bush White House. I've not had a very high opinion of his books myself. But I think the more serious problem that we face than Woodward is the fact that the press has, right up to and including preeminently the New York Times, has not kept the administration honest, has not kept government honest, and we, for the last how many years now, 10, 15, 20 years, and we face, I think, a very serious danger in this country from two sources. One is the now increasing prevalence of secrecy. And secrecy is not just in government, it's everywhere in this society, from the police station to the universities, you name it, we have secrecy. When you have secrecy, you get dishonesty. When you have dishonesty, you get incompetence. And I think that's one of our very serious problems throughout society. And the other one is that we are once again seeing a resurrection of the problem that first surfaced when Harry Truman went into Korea without congressional authorization in June of 1950, and Dean Acheson said this is not exactly the time to consider constitutionalism. We are getting an ever more powerful executive branch. Bush has made no, and Cheney too, and Harriet Myers. have made no secret of their desire to have an ever more powerful executive branch. And these folks pretend to be originalists. The originals, the founders, were desperately afraid of a powerful executive. You know, Ian, you seem to have an English accent, so you know about George III. Our founders knew about George III, and they wanted a legislative government, not an executive government. And we are the press has done nothing to forestall this tremendous surge towards executive government, in my opinion.
And you can add to that litany, Dean Velvel, that the new Chief Justice of the Supreme Court is a presidential lawyer, as was the Harriet Myers before she was torpedoed. So clearly the power of the executive branch is extending into the legislative. But there's some rumors that that Bob Woodward's source in revealing Valerie Wilson's name was, in fact, Vice President Cheney, and Vice President Cheney has lashed out this week. Particularly interestingly enough, he mentioned Senator Jay Rockefeller, who is the vice chair of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, and basically they recently, the Democrats, embarrassed Senator Pat Roberts by a Senate procedure into start oversight and stop covering up for the White House. So there's a possibility that the reason that Cheney is so upset is that the writing is on the wall, because once they find out how the intelligence was manipulated prior to the war, particularly the origins of the Niger forgeries, which may lead to Vice President's office via his neocon couriers like Michael Ledeen and others, then it'll get very interesting. So do you think the Vice President is feeling the heat?
I don't know much about Dick Cheney feeling the heat one way or the other. He ought to be feeling the heat. I think Dick Cheney did a lot of bad things in this administration. I think he did a lot of bad things as a congressman. It is kind of interesting that this man, it goes back a long way, but I just read a book by a California professor on admissions at Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, and Yale made a special exception, as it were, to take Dick Cheney, who promptly flunked out when only 2% of the population of the student body flunked out of Yale. I don't have a very high regard for Cheney. People say that he would not stickle at lying and hardball, and, you know, we've all seen the kind of things he's done. And quite frankly, one would like to know, wouldn't one? What was said on that airplane ride back from Norfolk when Cheney and Libby and a bunch of other people were there, and the whole outing seemed to have occurred very shortly thereafter? I have little doubt in my own mind. It's my own speculation, but I have little doubt in my own mind that Cheney is behind all this. And as only a few people have said, but there are a few people who have said, I'm one of them in my blogs, that you cannot put aside the possibility that Bush knew about all of this too, and that Bush was quite happy about it, and that Bush could conceivably bear some responsibility for it. Bush is like the Teflon man, you know. It's not widely known. People seem to ignore it. The press totally ignores the fact that we have a domestic felony statute. This is not the international treaties or anything like that. We have a domestic statute which makes it a criminal felony punishable by up to capital punishment for torture conducted by Americans abroad. If somebody dies in the torture, this is subject to capital punishment. And there's a conspiracy part which makes a conspirator liable for up to life imprisonment. And there just can't be any real question, but nobody wants to talk about this. I don't think there can be any real question but that President Bush knew what was going on, and probably with Cheney approved it because they were desperate to get information. One can understand the desperation. They were desperate to get information about possible future attacks on American soil and about attacks on our troops in Iraq. So I think, and yet, you know, that, and it's a, by the way, that this is an impeachable felony, but you can't get Congress to talk about it. You can't get the press to talk about it.
And you certainly won't get the Justice Department to do anything, because the Attorney General is the guy that drafted all of these torture memos. And, of course, it's worth noting here, Dean Velvel, that Admiral Stansfield Turner, the former Director of Central Intelligence, just referred to Dick Cheney as the Vice President of Torture. So the country has suffered inordinately, and this immoral and fruitless pursuit of torture has provided no actionable intelligence, but nothing but shame, disrepute, and lawsuits.
You know, one thing that's not widely rooted about is that the reason that people like John Yoo and Jay Bybee and Gonzalez and Addington and a bunch of others produced those torture memos, including the first memorandum, which said that if the president authorizes it as commander-in-chief, then no law applies. In other words, the president is above the law and can do anything he wants at all. The reason that this happened was that the CIA itself, and its general counsel in particular, were very concerned that what was going on in the way of torture might violate the domestic torture statute and might therefore subject CIA personnel to very serious punishments. And that's what led to you and Bybee in particular being the main authors of a memo that said the president is not bound by the law of Congress no matter what. As commander-in-chief, he can do whatever he wants.
You're referring, of course, to John Yoo at the Berkeley School of Law, not me.
No, yeah, correct. I'm referring
I just
to
wanted
John
to
Yoo,
make right. that real clear. Your blog, Dean Lawrence Velvel, is velvelonnationalaffairs.com for the audience who want to read in detail the scenario that we just laid out about what is really likely to have been happened here in terms of why Libby perjured himself and how the chips may fall. I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Lawrence Velvel.
Yeah, you're welcome, and thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Lawrence Velvel, who is one of the founders of the Massachusetts School of Law, where he currently serves as the dean. And again, velvelonnationalaffairs.com is his blog to get a better picture of his belief that the Vice President's Chief of Staff, Scooter Libby, intentionally fell on his sword by perjuring himself before the grand jury, knowing that that would delay and obfuscate the special prosecutor's prosecution. It's perhaps one of the reasons why Fitzgerald appears to be so determined. I'm now speaking with Lawrence Walsh, who's a distinguished attorney based in Oklahoma, served as the independent counsel for the historic Iran-Contra trial during the Reagan administration, which involved, of course, the president's current father and a number of persons not known as neocons back then, but now, of course, very much the architects of the Iraq War and the group that appear to have captured U.S. foreign policy and certainly have inordinate influence with the vice president. Lawrence Walsh, do you see any echoes from your experience with Iran-Contra in the current trial?
The possibility that Michael Ledeen might be involved. He was involved in Iran-Contra very deeply. He was the one who stimulated the effort to, really the message carrier from the Israeli arms merchants who wanted to sell arms to Iran. And these would be arms that were furnished by the United States to Israel. And he persuaded Robert McFarlane, President Reagan's
National Security Advisor,
National Security Advisor, that it would be helpful, that it would lead to the release of hostages that had been taken by a private terrorist organization that was loyal to Iran. The thought was that if we did a favor to Iran, that this hostage-taking group would release the American hostages. President Reagan was very deeply concerned for those hostages, and one of them was the area leader of the CIA for the whole Middle East, and so he was being tortured to try to get disclosures about our intelligence methodology and our intelligence agents in the Middle East. So both from a national point of view and from President Reagan's sympathetic point of view, he wanted to get those hostages out, and he was ready to do almost anything but not do business with the terrorist organizations directly. We have a strong policy, and we've urged our allies not to ransom hostages, because if we do, they'll simply take more hostages. And so President Reagan was open to persuasion by McFarlane. McFarlane was a very fine person, very decent person, but he'd been taken in by Michael Ledeen, who was professing that by making this, by giving the Israelis permission to sell American arms that they already received, to sell those arms to Iran, that it would do, it would help the get the hostages back.
And of course, Ledeen operated with Ghabonifar, Iranian arms dealer, who was a go-between. And in the connection here, I guess, is that Ledeen apparently organized another meeting in Rome with Ghabonifar and a couple of representatives from Doug Feith's Office of Special Plans in the Pentagon. And there is a connection here in terms of the Italians being allegedly the source of the forged documents that became the reason why Ambassador Wilson was sent to Niger to investigate claims that Saddam was trying to buy yellowcake uranium. And, of course, these claims proved as bogus as the documents they were based on.
Right.
And Wilson then went public in an op-ed speech piece in the New York Times in retaliation. The White House had Robert Novak leak the existence of his wife's CIA employment as an undercover officer, and that led to the special prosecutor. And I guess really, though, the connection, the more interesting connection is that the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, the vice chair, Senator Rockefeller, shortly after the Iraq war began, wrote a letter to the FBI director, Robert Mueller, asking for an investigation into the origin of the Niger forgeries. The chairman of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, Senator Pat Roberts, refused to sign off on this letter, but apparently an investigation was done, and that is the investigation that's being held up, and the very investigation that prompted the Democrats to shut the Senate down under a special rule to embarrass Senator Pat Roberts into completing what is called phase two of the investigation. So we may know more about links between the old Iran-Contra alumni and the current WMD scandal.
Right. Hi. Well, that's a hopeful sign, and that I think the Democrats probably did the right thing.
So this is, I guess, the genesis, though, of many, many ways of Iran-Contra goes back earlier to Iran, because there were some doubts as to whether or not there was a hand in what is called the October Surprise, the extent to which Carter was hung out to dry by hostage-taking. And then on the day of Reagan's inauguration, suddenly the hostages were released, and there was a number of people like Ted Koppel and others looked into it at great length. Nobody could actually find any smoking gun, but they sure found a lot of smoke.
That's the October Surprise when before Reagan became president.
Exactly.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Some of the same players were involved in that. Yeah. So I don't know whether you ever looked at those threads when you're looking into Iran-Contra.
Well, actually, we were held to a narrower scope of investigation than that. We were being criticized for the breadth of our investigation anyhow, but
well,
the person who was Reagan's emissary in that who was dealing with Reagan.
Well, I think it was Bill Casey, the who later became the director of CIA. He was at the time his campaign manager.
And who was on the Iranian side?
Well, there was Bani Sadr was the intermediary that they're supposed to be dealing with. I interviewed him a couple of times. I could never get anything out of him.
I see.
So, but I mean, there's just a lingering suspicion that there was a link here. But in terms of back to the analogies with Iran-Contra and the current case, do you think? I mean, just on a personal note, I get the feeling that Patrick Fitzgerald is personally angry that he was so misled, and that's what he said in his press conference, that he was like the umpire and that they threw sand in his face, and that the whole purpose of the perjury and obstruction of justice on the part of Scooter Libby was to slow the investigation down and delay him. So do you think that kind of activity tends to make to backfire and make a prosecutor more determined?
Oh yes, any excuse me, anything that suggests a deliberate effort to distort his investigation or to block it will provoke, I think, obviously, a reaction. And the big problem with, as I sympathize with Mr. Fitzpatrick, is that the Ashcroft Deputy Attorney General, who fixed the scope of Mr. Fitzpatrick's investigation, gave him too narrow an authority. I don't know whether I would have accepted it. He narrowed it to this disclosure of one secret, one of the secret relationship of one person to the CIA. Whereas I think it should have been an investigation into a possible conspiracy to mislead the president and the Congress as to weapons of mass destruction in an effort to get them to go to war. Now, with a broad investigation, he could not have been frustrated by the perjury of a single witness. But the narrower the investigation, the more difficult it is, because you have less room to maneuver as a prosecutor. If you have a broad investigation with multiple lines of inquiry going forward at the same time, one will tend to feed the other. You learn something in one that feeds the other. Whereas Mr. Fitzpatrick was limited to this one very narrow thing, and the possible frustration of it by a single person that you just mentioned, Scooter Libby, shows that it can be at least delayed and perhaps blocked to a deeper investigation.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Lawrence Walsh, but in the investigation itself, the Bush administration were reluctant to conduct. A criminal referral came from the CIA. Months went by before the Justice Department did anything. They were finally embarrassed into naming a special prosecutor, and as you mentioned, they narrowed his scope considerably. But even so, it still appears to have yielded something. I thank you so much for joining us, Lawrence Walsh.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking there with Lawrence Walsh, who was the independent counsel for the Iran-Contra trials during the Reagan administration. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Jazz Shepard, the engineer, Carol Cuth, the assistant producer. This and all other programs are available at ianmasters.org.